conscience to go down to the lower level. They want to be part of the higher level, and their reaction is one of these concealment reactions of bluffing, hypocrisy, diversion, and so on like that. So this is what Boisen is talking about. And when these people pile up, that's when the church, he says, gets a bad name. So under concealment, he says, now I'm starting to read on page 154. We have a number of common protective devices and means of evasions. 154.
The list, it switches from the last column back to the fourth column. You're going down the fourth column, under the last column.
First I just went across. And then we'll discuss these different levels one after another. When he discusses these, when he gets to the end, the concealment, then he starts going across. So when there's concealment. And concealment also means concealing from yourself. That's part of it. So the reaction of compromise, that's under concealment, that's his first idea there, is especially common among those who would cling to their primary loyalties without paying the price of complete commitment essential to the attainment of higher levels of development. The frequency of this reaction among religious people is responsible for the charge that religion itself is an escape from reality. So this is what tends to gather, especially among religious people, because they profess a higher standard than everybody else. And they believe in it. Yet they don't want to pay the price of complete commitment. Not really. What he's saying is, you understand you surrender to Krishna, but when it really comes down to it, you can't quite bring yourself to do it. Yet you want to be accepted and recognized as a surrendered person. See, our problem in ISKCON, as I see it, is that many, many, many more people are attracted to the principles of Krishna consciousness than are actually willing or able to follow them. What to do? The fact that people are attracted is good. Now, my suggestion is, and this is just a suggestion, as this is why Prabhupada started to think about Varnashram Dharma. Because originally, Prabhupada said, we didn't need it. We are all Vaishnavas. What do we need Varnashram Dharma for? But as he saw in the movement, more and more people were attracted, but who actually weren't able to strictly follow all the principles of Vaidhi Bhakti, he began to think about Varnashram Dharma. So something to think about, I'm just putting this forward, is if you look at this in Boisen terms, Varnashram Dharma is the way of actually institutionalizing level two in socialization, the normal man. I mean, it's normal on a much higher level than what would be considered normal in Western society. Because all of Western society is, from the perspective of Varnashram Dharma, something like a criminal gang. But, isn't it? But that's what it looks like. Because when in ISKCON, as I talked earlier, we disowned our congregation. When we own up to our congregation, that means Varnashram Dharma is a way for people to make much more gradual, so they don't go away. So they are socialized in some way that is still connected with our higher level. I mean, this raises many, many questions, and I don't even want to get into them here. But that's just something to think about. Because what you'll have otherwise, you see, it was always struck me as a difficulty, the only way that you could be socialized within ISKCON is to get initiated. Because then you get your spiritual name. Now, I once had a young woman come to me who wanted to be a disciple of mine. She really was hanging around ISKCON for many years, and she wanted to be a disciple. And it became clear to me that she just couldn't understand what it meant to be surrendered. She would only do whatever service was convenient for her at some particular time. That idea of complete commitment, she just liked devotees, and she liked hanging out with devotees, and she wanted to belong to devotees, and she liked making garlands. But she had another life. She didn't really want to give up a television, you know, like this. And yet she really wanted to be a part of ISKCON. Anyway, she married somebody, and then they got divorced because he discovered he was an initiated devotee, that she wasn't really serious. And she kept writing to me and stuff like that and wanting to get initiated. All I could see, all she really wanted was a spiritual name. Then one day I was visiting a temple community far away from my place where she was living. And I saw her. And somebody said, "Oh, that's so-and-so Devi." "Oh, where did she get the name from?" "Well, she just gave it to herself, Lakshmi Devi or something, you know." And she was happy. You know, she got a name, and that was all she wanted, really. You know? She just gave herself a name. She sat down with some friends and said, "What would be a good name, you know? And I'd like to have a name, and why not?"
Well, our kids are not initiated.
Yeah. We have a problem with some Gaudiya Math people whose idea of initiation is you just give people a name, but they don't really have that kind of commitment that Prabhupada has with Harinam initiation. And that's why, you know, some people who preach in India wanted to have some kind of pre-initiation, because otherwise people become socialized in some other group rather than in ISKCON. So we face this problem that really to be socialized in ISKCON, right now the major act of being officially part of ISKCON is initiation. And therefore many people felt impelled to take the vows of initiation before they're really either willing or able to live up to them. And rather than, you know, like Prabhupada waited 12 years. I mean, there's nothing really wrong with waiting 12 years, but sometimes you don't feel like you belong. One reason you don't feel like you belong is there's a lot of people either grossly or subtly giving you the message you don't belong. Pushing you to get initiated. And it used to be that way. I mean, when I was a new devotee, I mean, it was, boy, either black or white, either or. Much more than it is now, usually. But it was heavy. Anyway, let's go on here. So he's talking about compromise. So here's people who really want to be socialized in the highest level, religious people, but still don't want to pay the price. The frequency of this reaction among... So you understand what he's talking here. Cling to their primary loyalties without paying the price of the complete commitment essential to the attainment of the highest levels of development. Which means really total surrender. Prabhupada said about pure devotees, he said, they do not mind what becomes of the future of their lives. Most people in ISKCON do mind. And to get to the point where you don't mind takes a great deal of advancement. He was talking about pure devotees, about Lord Jesus Christ, about Thakur Haridas. They'll do anything for Krishna. They say, "Krishna, my future belongs to you. I'm just going to follow your orders, and whatever comes, I accept. I'm making no plans for the future." And as soon as you say that in a Bhagavatam class, somebody says, isn't that irresponsible? Shouldn't you have life insurance? Shouldn't you make, plans for your old age and all this other stuff? Prabhupada told us that for men, the plan for their old age is, you pick up a danda and head out to the woods, And nobody even knows where or when you leave your body, right? That's a very high level. We had a meeting with the Gaudiya Mutt last year about trying to get together with them and the Jayapataka Maharaj organized. What problems do we have in common? And their problem is they have all these old sannyasis that somebody has to take care of. Because there, they don't have any disciples because they have the single acharya system. There's no disciples to take care of them. And many of them are old and infirm.
And they don't have anything like Social Security.
Don't have anything like Social Security.
No pension.
Yeah, no pension, no anything like that.
Oh, they're not initiating?
No. They only have, their system is in every month there's only one initiating guru.
All other sannyasis
don't. They don't. They spring to the acharya and he initiates. Anyway, but the real, but really, one is not supposed to mind what becomes the future of your lives. Prabhupada set the example at the age of 70, without any money, he went across the ocean. He wasn't thinking about his pension. Well, what'll I do in my old age? So anyway, the frequency of this compromised reaction among religious people is responsible for the charge that religion itself is an escape from reality. Here would belong the case encountered in my survey work of a minister with an unresolved sex conflict and guilty of marital infidelity. He was having sex with somebody other than his wife, whose sermons were confined to such themes as keeping the Sabbath. In other words, always going to church on Sunday. Or something like that. That was to him was the main thing. So his big thing, that of following one of the basic Ten Commandments, he couldn't follow. So some small thing that you must always go to church on Sunday, because that's what he was doing. He was doing that right. This little thing he was doing right. The big thing he was doing wrong. So the little thing was what he could preach about. I mean, how many devotees have I run across who are not very good at following the basic principles of Krishna consciousness, but are very interested in preaching vegetarianism, for example? And they say, yeah, I met somebody and I convinced him to become a vegetarian. And what was Prabhupada's reaction when somebody come and say, I'm a vegetarian? Monkeys are vegetarian. Why did Prabhupada react like that? Because he wanted to bring them to a higher level. So we'll see these things in our movement. Here's this minister whose sermons were confined to such themes as keeping the Sabbath, and that also of another minister with a similar conflict, an adulterous minister, whose constant concern was correctness of ritual and loyalty to his denomination. It's very important that you be a Presbyterian. These men, because of their own inner disharmony, were unable to hold before their people the really significant social ideals and symbols without discomfort to themselves. If they preached about the real thing, they would feel guilty. So they preached about the little things. They escaped this discomfort by substituting other symbols. This reaction of compromise through substitution of minor for major virtues and loyalties is to be found in ritualism, legalism, pedantry, sectarianism, superpatriotism, at least when these are characterized by attitudes of intolerance. Do we understand all those words? I want to make sure, huh? Ritualism. In other words, devotion to rituals. exacting rituals, huh?
Niyamagraha.
Yeah, niyamagraha. Too much following of regulative principles just for the sake of following them. Legalism. Same thing, but on the level of exactly following the laws. A person who may be obsessively about... So, Prabhupada, he chanted his noon Gayatri about 2 o'clock in the afternoon. You're supposed to chant it 15 minutes before, 15 minutes after noon. You're supposed to chant your morning Gayatri, while you can still see the last stars in the sky, with the sun, the light of the sun is coming up, Somebody for whom those... So if you see this compromise, he uses the term punctiliousness. Punctilious, it means being very exact, being very scrupulous or careful in exact details of the codes or the conventions, where you have to make sure you dot all the I's and cross the T's. You're being very strict, attentive to minute details of forms of action or conduct. That's this word. It's on the chart here. Punctiliousness. Punctiliousness. It's in one of the attitudes after cynicism and fault finding. We'll go back to those later. This is a substitution. And then he says the types over there, the end result, is the legalist, the Pharisee. Pharisee in the Bible. Now, this is maybe given a bad name. There was a Jewish sect at the time of Jesus that were called the Pharisees. Oh, ye scribes and Pharisees, ye hypocrites! So the Pharisees, the Bible, the New Testament gives them a very bad name, and perhaps it's generally considered by many Christians today to have been a little unfair, leading to anti-Semitism. But anyway, they were a Jewish sect who were noted for very strict observances of the rules and the ceremonies of the written law and also the oral tradition. Like the Smarta Brahmanas. Actually, it really is Karma Kanda religion. Karma Kanda religion. If you read the Smarta codes, if you read the Smarta codes, what a Brahmin has to do to pass stool, it blows your mind. And every time he does something wrong, he goes to hell for so many thousands of years. If he looks back and sees his own stool, he must go to this hell for so many years. It's all on the basis of rewards and punishments. If the shadow of an untouchable touches you, then you have to take a bath, you have to do this, you have to do that. The Pharisee is somebody we would say is generally pharisaical. Somebody who's a Pharisee is hypocritical, especially with attitudes of criticizing others. If you don't follow it, they blame. They're always nitpicking, what we call in English nitpick, Nits are those little things that get in your hair, those little insects. You pick out the nits. The monkeys do it all the time, right? Fleas or nits. Nitpicking. Pick, 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 picky, 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 picky. All we're getting. So when you see people get very obsessed with exact details, sometimes this happens to Pujaris. And one gets very self-righteous, about the whole thing. So this can be...
Pronunciation sometimes.
Yeah, sometimes pronunciation. It can be, but sometimes it gets on your nerves, though, and people don't learn the basics of correct pronunciation. But at least we have to... when you're dealing with scholars, you should say bhakti and not bhakti, So these are the kind of things he's talking about. This is a substitute. When it gets really obsessive, constant, and always criticizing others, then you can see that there's something, usually it's a sign that we've got something, when we find ourselves doing it, you know, you should look and see, wait a minute, maybe there's something wrong, I've got some disquiet of conscience, I should look and see. You know, what it really bothers me that nobody puts their tilak on right. And this becomes a major thing for me. When I go on a crusade about tilak or about, you know, whatever it may be. Something like that. For no really good reason.
But especially if there are very much attempts to resolve the
At least when these are characterized by attitudes of intolerance, pedantry, you know, this whole thing about, just like bhakti and bhakti, you know, you make little.
Bhajans.
Then he says, a man may be punctilious, very careful, about the tithing of mint and anise and cumin, precisely because he is deficient in the weightier matters of the law.
Isn't that a reference to it?
Something in the Bible. I don't really know where it is, but somewhere it says there's an old Jewish law that you should tithe, that is, give a certain percent of anise, mint, and cumin, valuable spices. You know? So you may be very good about doing these things precisely, while the big things are gone. And this is always together with the attitude of fault-finding of other people. They usually go together. See, he's taking him in this significance. But if you look at here, this compromise, the attitude, first attitude is cynicism. You know what cynic means? It actually comes from a Greek word meaning like a dog. And a cynic is one who has the conviction that nobody else is acting from good motives. Generally, the word cynic means, I looked all these up in the dictionary for you people. Everyone else is motivated wholly by self-interest. You may seem to be doing things for other people, but actually you're only looking out for yourself. And I'm convinced that everybody else has got this fault. That's cynic. A fault-finding, captious critic. You know, you're always trying to get people in arguments and trying to defeat them and trying to find fault with them. And it's that belief that human conduct is motivated by self-interest. There was a group of Greek philosophers that were called cynics. So generally it's come down in English to mean a person who... So we say somebody is cynical. He believes everybody has bad motives except for him. And they're ill-motivated.
Well, he may even feel he has bad motives also.
Usually in this case, because it's compromised, you're being self-righteous. So the attitude of fault-finding, which is in a cynicism fault-finding, is that everybody is at fault but me. But as Prabhupada points, see, I think usually when you point your finger at somebody, there's three fingers pointing back at you. And usually what you're on everybody's case about is often just exactly what your own fault is. I've noticed this. When people make statements about ISKCON, it's almost always autobiography. And this is also another reaction, shifting the blame. When people have become disappointed in their spiritual life and are not making any progress, they say, ISKCON is no good, ISKCON is useless, ISKCON is this, ISKCON is that. It's almost always they're talking about their own spiritual state. Whereas somebody who's making spiritual progress and has hope for their future spiritual life, they feel pretty good about ISKCON too. I've just noticed that. It's almost, be careful when you say something about ISKCON, because you might be giving yourself away. Because part of the blame shifting is that if I'm not successful in my spiritual life, it must be ISKCON's fault. People, and bitterness is there. We see bitterness is down there as one of the attitudes that as a concealment reaction. So there's cynicism and fault finding, maintenance of self-respect through depreciation of others. See, I'm worried about myself, but if I'm fallen, everybody else has to be too. So that fault finding tendency is there. Now I have here from this is our Anchalila chapter 8. Now this is the story about Ramachandrapuri Goswami, who came to see Paramananda Puri and Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Paramananda Puri offered respects at the feet of Ramachandrapuri, and Ramachandrapuri strongly embraced him. Now, Ramachandrapuri was a disciple of Madhavendrapuri. And therefore, in other words, a godbrother of Chaitanya's spiritual master and Paramananda Puri's spiritual master, Ishwara Puri. So they treated him just like their spiritual master. Bhakti, Ramachandrapuri was naturally very envious and against the principles of Vaishnavism. Common people nevertheless addressed him as a Goswami or Gosani because he was superficially in the renounced order and dressed like a sannyasi. He's bluffing. It's called bluff. Dumba. Hypocrite. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu also offered obeisances under Ramachandrapuri, who embraced him and thus remembered Krishna. So, that said, three of them talked about Krishna for some time, and then Jagadananda came and extended an invitation to Ramachandrapuri. A large quantity of the remnants for food from Lord Jagannath was brought in for distribution. Ramachandrapuri ate sumptuously. And then he wanted to find fault with Jagadananda Pandit. So he ate his fill. After finishing the meal, Ramachandrapuri requested, "My dear Jagadananda, please listen, eat the food that's left." With great earnestness, Ramachandrapuri seated Jagadananda Pandit and personally served him prasad. Encouraging him again and again, Ramachandrapuri fed him sumptuously. But when Jagadananda had washed his hands and mouth, Ramachandrapuri began to criticize him. "I have heard," he said, "that the followers of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu eat more than necessary. This is his crusade, overeating. And we'll find out where he was deficient. Now I have directly seen that this is true. Feeding a sannyasi too much breaks his regulative principles. For a sannyasi eats too much, his renunciation is destroyed." So that was his banner. A sannyasi should not eat too much, right? The characteristic of Ramachandrapuri was that first he would induce someone to eat more than necessary and then he would criticize him. He had to have it happen. It was necessary to him. So if nobody was satisfying him in this regard, he would push him at it, yeah?
But he also, like, when they go the other way and then they don't eat enough, he criticizes them and says the renunciation is false.
Let's see when we get to that, okay? Formally, now it tells the story. After saying his characteristic, now it tells you his story. How did he get this way? Formerly, when Madhavendrapuri was at the last stage of his life, Ramachandrapuri came to where he was staying. Madhavendrapuri was chanting the holy name of Krishna, and sometimes he would cry, "Oh my Lord, I did not get shelter at Mathura." So what is explained here, somewhere along the line, is that, of course, Madhavendrapuri was speaking prayers in the mood of separation of Srimati Radharani. So he was feeling the ecstasy of love for Krishna in the mood of separation. In other words, he was on the absolutely highest platform of ecstasy. This took the form of a lamentation. I did not get you shelter. I really, meaning Radharani speaking. He's remembering her a feeling. Then Ramachandrapuri was so foolish that he fearlessly dared to instruct his spiritual master. This is the weightier matter of the law, right? If you are in full transcendental bliss, he said, you should now remember only Brahman. Why are you crying? The sojitina constantly, right? You don't lament and you don't anchor. So you're lamenting. You should be remembering Brahman. You see, he was on a much lower level than his spiritual master, and he interpreted his ecstasy as ordinary lamentation. And so therefore, he created a great offense. He was just trying to instruct his spiritual master. Hearing this instruction, Madhavendrapuri, greatly angry, rebuked him by saying, "Get out, you sinful rascal." Duradur Papishta. Duradur Papishta. Duradur. Go, go, Papishta. Papishta. Bully, he said. In this way, he chastised him. So then the purport explains what was going on. He was reprimanded this way. And then Madhavendrapuri says, "Oh, my Lord Krishna, I could not reach you, nor could I reach your abode, Mathura. I am dying in my unhappiness, and now this rascal has come to give me more pain." "Don't show your face to me. Go anywhere else you like. If I die seeing your face, I shall not achieve the destination of my life. I am dying without achieving the shelter of Krishna, and therefore I am greatly unhappy. Now this condemned foolish rascal has come to instruct me about Brahman." Ramachandrapuri was, and apparently he didn't understand. He didn't feel bad. "You know, well, somebody didn't understand me. You know, I'm only trying to help you." You know, something like that. Ramachandrapuri was thus denounced by Madhavendrapuri. Due to his offense, gradually material desires appeared within him. That was a comment anyway. One who was attached to drive, because of this material desires, he became a jnani. One who is attached to dry speculative knowledge, Brahmagyan, Shuksha Brahmagyani, has no relationship with Krishna. His occupation is criticizing Vaishnavas. Thus he is situated in criticism. Nindate Nirbandha, fixed in blasphemy. So he had a steady desire to criticize others. Right? That's right there on that list, right? First thing. Cynicism, fault-finding. And then punctiliousness. So we'll see all these, this cluster here in modern. He's maintaining his self-respect now. He's just had the devastating loss. And he didn't accept it. It wasn't that he was, the chastising was one thing, but he didn't accept it. He still was now having failed. And the simple test of a devotee of surrender to the spiritual master, now he's still going to be a great devotee. And so therefore he was handed over to impersonal ideas without really knowing it. Then by contrast, it described a godbrother of his, Ishwarapuri, Lord Chaitanya's spiritual master. Ishwarapuri, the spiritual master of Lord Chaitanya, performed service to Madhavendrapuri, cleaning up his stool and urine with his own hand, because at the end he was infirm and incontinent, so he couldn't, he was taking care of this way. Ishwarapuri was always chanting the holy name and pastimes of Lord Krishna for Madhavendrapuri to hear. In this way, he helped Madhavendrapuri remember the holy name and pastimes of Lord Krishna at the time of death. Pleased with Ishwara Puri, Madhavendra Puri embraced him and gave him the benediction that he would be a great devotee and lover of Krishna. Thus, Ishwara Puri became like an ocean of ecstatic love for Krishna, whereas Ramchandra Puri became a dry speculator and a critic of everyone else. So he was still interested in transcendence, but now it had to be Brahman, since he could no longer have any feelings for Krishna. Ishwara Puri received the blessings of Madhavendra Puri, whereas Ramachandra Puri received a rebuke from him. Therefore, these two persons, Ishwara Puri, Ramachandra Puri, are example of the objects of a great person's benediction and punishment. Madhavendra Puri instructed the entire world by presenting these two examples. Then it describes a little more about Madhavendra Puri's ecstasy and how he chanted this sloka beginning, Ayi Dina Dharajya Natahe, and so on. Thus, Ramachandra Puri stayed at Jagannath Puri. As customary for those in the renounced order, he would sometimes stay someplace and then go away. There was no certainty of where Ramachandra Puri would take his meal, for he would do so, even uninvited. He would just drop in without notice. Nevertheless, he was very particular to keep account of how others were taking their meals. Punctiliousness. To invite Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu would cost 320 kodis. It says here a kodi is a small conch shell. This would provide lunch for three people, including Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and sometimes Kashishwara and Govinda. In other words, they would get the Mahaprasadam from Jagannath. You can still do that at Puri. Every day the Lord would take his meal at a different place, and if somebody was prepared to pay for a meal, the price was fixed at only 4 punas. Ramchandra Puri concerned himself with gathering all sorts of information about how Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was situated, including his regulative principles, his lunch, his sleep, and his movements. Well, naturally, he's on the level of his spiritual master, so he's going to check him out, right? Because Ramchandra Puri was interested only in finding fault, he could not understand the transcendental qualities of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. His only concern was finding faults, but still he could not find any. At last he found a fault. How can a person in the renounced order eat so many sweetmeats, he said. Candy, huh? Sweets. Sweetmeat. An old-fashioned word. If one eats sweets, controlling the senses is very difficult. In this way, Ramchandra Puri blasphemed Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu before everyone. But nevertheless, he would regularly come to see the Lord every day. Notice that's interesting. He has to see him every day too. When they met the Lord, now listen, look how Lord Chaitanya dealt with him. The Lord would offer him respectful obeisances, considering him to be a godbrother of his spiritual master. Ramchandra Puri's business, however, was to search for the faults in the Lord. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu knew that Ramchandra Puri was criticizing him before everyone. But whenever Ramchandra Puri came to see him, the Lord offered him respects with great attention. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu did not respond in kind. One day Ramchandra Puri came in the morning to the abode of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Seeing many ants, he said something to criticize the Lord. Last night there were sugar candy here, he said. Therefore ants are wandering about. Alas, this renounced sannyasi is attached to such sense gratification. After speaking in this way, he got up and left. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu had heard rumors about Ramchandra Puri's blasphemy. Now he directly heard his fanciful accusation. I mean, there are ants everywhere, right? It says this. Ants generally crawl about here, there, and everywhere. But Ramchandra Puri, looking for imaginary faults, criticized Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu by alleging that there had been sweetmeats in his room. After hearing this criticism, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was doubtful and apprehensive. So anyway, the story goes on. We have to end our class now. So we'll consider this. But you can see that we have an archetypical example of concealment, of this concealment reaction here and all the things that are exactly there in that Boisen is talking about. And any questions? Yeah. We were discussing. Any questions from last class? Oops. Discussing here in this chart, we're on the level of the concealments. Dr. Gerald asked yesterday about whether people knew what they were doing, and you notice that the degree of awareness is confused. So when people are concealing things, as I understand it, the first person they're deceiving is themselves. Now, the self-deception is mentioned in Srimad Bhagavatam, as a matter of fact. I don't remember where, but I remember that picture of all those different things that were created by Brahma, and one of them is self-deception. So it's in the Detroit temple. It's that picture. So self-deception is definitely something that we recognize. In other words, but the mechanism of self-deception is if a person, as I understand it, this is what I guess modern, where he says concealment, modern psychiatric or psychological jargon in America anyway, people use the expression in denial. Hey, somebody is in denial. When there's something going on, they just don't want to admit to themselves. Right? It's the same thing as, I think, concealment or self-deception. So you may be familiar, some of you may be familiar with the expression, he's in denial. It's all part of what is called in America psychobabble. People are, so this when there's concealment, when these concealment reactions are there, you see, it causes within a person a great deal of tension, because when there's concealment, you're doing something, and at the same time, you're not letting yourself know that you're doing it. So when you do this, like when we have this, when you're fault finding with somebody, and you really have something that you're worried about with yourself, but you can't really admit it, and so you look for faults in other people to make yourself feel better by making other people feel worse.